All right, welcome to the Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
How are you guys doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. I definitely still on a high, a little tired, but on a high from the Quantum Summit, which has been awesome.
It's been a fantastic 2 days.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Crazy.
That's why we're doing the show a little later than usual.
Yep.
Not because we came into the office late, but because we wrapped up the Quantum Bitcoin.
We're still out having a picnic right now.
Yeah.
We're skipping the picnic to come do...
Bummer.
Just yeah, for the, come hang out with each other.
Just for audience.
Yeah. We'd rather hang out with all of you guys.
Yeah.
We've also been hanging out with these people for the last 36 hours, so it's good.
So what was the Quantum Bitcoin Summit at Presidio Bitcoin? Who wants to tackle that?
Well, so Presidio Bitcoin was hosting the Quantum Bitcoin Summit. And, you know, this question has been coming up a lot. I think we've talked about it over months and stuff.
Specifically, the Willow
thing.
I guess December, I think we covered it.
Wow, that was
one of our early topics.
That feels like a year ago.
But people keep asking, right? People are like, well, what's the deal with quantum? And is this a real risk to the future of Bitcoin? And so I don't know if you proposed it or how it all came together, but there's a, at Presidio Bitcoin, the last day and a half has been a bunch of leading crypto, quantum computing experts have come in, and then we've got a bunch of quantum Bitcoin experts and builders, and we sort of got everybody together and learned a lot from the presentations, gathered together to discuss and sort of do breakouts, and just a lot of just hanging out and meeting people and general just conversation around this topic. So my kind of understanding from hearing what I heard was like, certainly there's a lot of good discussion going on. Probably need to kind of keep the cadence of this because we're not in a problem state right now, but we want to be aware and ready and kind of like have some cohesion and network of how to discuss these and who are the experts and who to bring together. So I didn't feel like it's like, oh, alarmist, this is happening next month, let's all change. But it's like, hey, if this were to happen over the course of the next 2 years or 5 years or 7 or 8 years, how do we think about laying the foundation and making the kinds of changes and what kinds of compromises or changes will we need to make Bitcoin secure and safe in a world? And there's certainly everything's compromises, everything's trade-offs. So
let me ask you guys, I mean, there's several different difficult questions with this topic. One is if and when cryptographically relevant quantum computing will even exist. I'm curious for each of you, having now attended this event, do you believe it's going to happen sooner than you previously thought or farther away than you previously thought or unchanged?
Yeah, so I'll preface this by saying I'm obviously not a quantum expert. I think it's fascinating. And one of my big takeaways from, the whole, summit is I want to learn a lot more about quantum in general. Not just quantum computing, which I think is a really fascinating application, but also just... I had some very interesting conversations with some of the folks around, like, why does quantum computing even work? And I have a few physicists and philosophers I need to go deeper on. And anyways, adding to my stack of books. But in terms of the short-term stuff, I would say I am leaving roughly the same in terms of my concern level, maybe slightly. I would say I have a slightly more accelerated view of how quickly this thing could go. So in general, I mean, for me, like the biggest sort of like alpha of the whole event was the PsiQuantum CTO, the guy he presented. Yep. PsiQuantum, for those of you who don't know, is apparently, it's a private company, but they've raised from like BlackRock and like all of the major, institutional funds, founders funds in there. And from everything I'm hearing, they're apparently the leader. Like I've heard credible sources claim they're even ahead of Google, which sounds pretty crazy to me. But if that's the case, then we just got to hear from one of the leaders in the whole field, which was really, really interesting. And one of the things that, both he and there was another quantum researcher, I forget, who was also very interesting. And, they both kind of seem to like converge on a 5-year-ish timeframe. We probably are going to have something that could break ECDSA, which is the specific cryptography that Bitcoin uses for key addresses. And it's both were kind of in that 2030 timeframe. Show said 5 years. I forget the other guy's name now, the CTO. What's his name? Matt? No.
Terry,
thank you. Yeah. And he said
five years, one day,
exactly, which is a very smart
right
way to bet.
Price is right.
Yeah,
exactly. But so I thought they kind of converged on that, which was interesting to me. However, I chatted with Terry a little bit afterwards and was kind of asking, and this is you know, eventually a topic we're going to discuss later today, which is like, hey, Terry, imagine, you know, a world where energy is free, the marginal cost of electricity is effectively zero, and you could wave a magic wand. Like, how would you sprint to get there faster? And there's two kinds of fields of quantum computing that he was most excited about. There's the sort of traditional cold qubit quantum computing, which requires what he said is a fundamental breakthrough in refrigeration that we don't have yet. So you can't just like throw electricity at it. And then the other one, which they what they're doing, which is photonics. And with photonics, you know, I was kind of asking, what is the big bottleneck? And one of the bottlenecks that came out was sort of robotics to connect chips to fiber. And I'm assuming this is happening at a very, very small scale. And so that to me was very interesting because I was like, if that's the case, that seems like a solvable problem. And if it's a solvable problem and it's a problem solved by robotics, I think one thing that no one was sort of like bullish enough on at the summit was how progress in traditional AI and robotics could potentially accelerate that timeline. So imagine a world where Elon drops another new robot that can do the sort of chip attachment at a, you know, 1000x faster rate. Well, then all of a sudden, my sort of like gut intuition is that 2030 timeline, maybe that could be 2027 or 2028. So anyways, long story short, I think I'm probably just from everything I learned, think it's going to happen sooner than we think. However, I'm also not that worried because, you know, I'm sure we'll go into more details on this, but like, I think we can have post-quantum, you know, address types. Yes, they're going to be fatter, you know, whatever, thicker for the blockchain, but like, it's not an unsolvable problem. And I'm also kind of the camp and remain of the camp that like the old addresses, you just let it lie, free markets are going to free market, and there's a bounty for people to develop a quantum computer. So those are my takeaways.
Yeah, I'm kind of similar that, I mean, I think my default position is that it's always hard to predict the pace of technology adoption and sort of technology breakthroughs. You know, I think I remember back, was it like Craig Venter trying to map the human genome, and they were saying this is going to take 20 years, and then it was done like, you know, a year or two later or something. You know, in the 90s. But that kind of pattern seems to repeat again and again. You know, Transformers, the paper came out in 2017, nothing much happened. It was kind of slower than you might expect if you were really paying attention. But then when it happened, it happens again so quickly when a breakthrough finally occurs. And so I think like trying to handicap exactly when it is, like I think it's not tomorrow, but it's far enough away. You know, but like 5 years still seems about right, something in that range. The thing that I was trying to get more clarity from, is it Sia? The guy, who is the one CEO that you mentioned?
Show,
okay. Wait, what was that company? Do you remember the name of it?
No, BlockQ.
BlockQ, yeah. So he was kind of starting from the point of like, you know, there are about 100,000 physicists in the world who could do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, maybe he said 100,000 physicists in the world. And so I was asking him, are we mostly bottlenecked by like thinking, algorithms, new approaches, or are we bottlenecked by like the physical, like the refrigeration, the photonics, the connectivity and like physical world stuff? And he had not really sort of imagined what happened if we had 1 million physicists. And it's like on the information side of it.
Right.
And so if we had 1 million physicists, like will we get like that special move from AlphaGo? Where
yes.
It actually, it doesn't quite make sense to us intuitively, but once you see it, you're like, oh, I get it. Okay, that's how it's done.
And where might we get 1 million physicists from?
Yeah, exactly, right? So AI, you know, 1 million physicists are coming from Jensen Huang.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to handicap these things. 5 years feels about right, but I actually am quite happy that we all got together and heard all the people who would know the most about this. And I didn't feel like anybody was panicked, but everybody feels like they're well, you know, networked now and able to know who to go to get feedback on stuff and to discuss. So I would say like I come out with more confidence that like we've got our best people kind of engaged in it.
I think the 5-year timeline is like hyper aggressive. So I thought before and still think it's going to be much longer than that. Certainly acknowledging not an expert on quantum computers, and B, just we're all uncertain. I mean, I agree it could happen fast, and it I just don't think that happening fast moment is going to be in 5 years. I would still think it's 15 or 20 years away. If it does happen in 5 years,
I'm glad we have this recorded.
Yeah, exactly.
We can look back.
We're on the record now.
If it does happen in 5 years, then that that'll be very disruptive for the whole world, even beyond Bitcoin, but certainly disrupt Bitcoin. I don't think the world will be prepared for it. It'll be quite bad. And then for Bitcoin, I definitely feel way more confident today than 2 days ago, and much more confident than 6 months ago, in terms of like the level of thought, the quality of people thinking about this problem.
Mm-hmm.
At least from my own awareness, has gone from like almost no one to some people I already know and have respect for that are thinking about it, developing good proposals. And like what we covered in the event is like outlined all the big questions and problems. And each one, we have several proposals, none of which are fully fleshed out. That's why if we need to do something in the next 5 years, it's going to be chaos. As long as we have enough, if it happens as soon as 5 years, but we have enough of a head start to like start making decisions, I think we'll get to the other side, but it'll be like a very hamstrung Bitcoin. Like we'll lose, we'll lose multisig and like HD wallets and like these just foundational things that we use today, but they weren't in the original Bitcoin either. So it's almost like a reset in many ways of Bitcoin, the network and technology. That doesn't necessarily reset the price or the market that's developed. So I think we can get to the other side. But what would be much better and smoother would be we get another 10 to 15 years of post-quantum cryptography R&D.
Yeah.
So that we're not having transition to like relatively clunky cryptography.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say clunky, relative to what we're using today in Bitcoin, and be able to utilize all that progress, which I'm sure is inevitable, because there's going to be progress on AI is going to help us there probably. And like
energy is going to get really cheap, right?
So, yeah, anyway, I still think it's like, I would be pretty stressed if it's 5 years away.
But one big takeaway I would say, seemed to be, how do you get to consensus, which is a topic you've written about a lot and thought about a lot. But like, how do you convince enough people that it is a problem at the right time so that you can make the somewhat painful changes required?
Totally.
It's not like we don't know how to do it. It's like it comes with trade-offs. And we all have to agree that like, quantum's a big enough deal now, or it's going to be a big enough deal 6 months from now, that we should start implementing and agreeing.
So summarize some of the decisions that need to be made, which we just we covered in the event, but just for our audience. So one is simply moving to new cryptography. Post-quantum cryptography means cryptography that can withstand a quantum computer and Shor's algorithm and algorithms applied to a quantum computer.
And to be specific on that for people listening, like when we're talking about actually signing a transaction, we're no longer going to be able to use the old form of cryptography for that. So it has to be post-quantum.
Yeah. And so there are a number of post-quantum cryptography solutions today. They all have major drawbacks compared to what we're used to in Bitcoin today, ranging from their signatures are much, much larger. The keys are much larger. So that just means you can fit less transactions in a block. It slows down the velocity of being able to move money. It would increase the fees a single transaction would need to pay to get mined. So it hurts scaling. To generate a signature requires dramatically more. It's more computationally intensive. So all of a sudden, everyone's like Ledger and Trezor and BitKey, they couldn't even sign a transaction anymore. They don't have enough comp. It would take, years for them to sign a transaction.
Maybe the compute on like a hardware device?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a trade-off. And then, you can pick different cryptography, which gains on one and you lose on the other. There's trade-offs there.
It's also worth mentioning on those cryptography types. So I came away with kind of three big buckets of potential signatures we could move to. One, which I thought Lalo gave a great presentation, I think everyone should check out, I think was called NIST. I forget that.
Sphinx.
Sphinx, sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not Sphinx Chat, but Sphincs Plus. And that was interesting to me because that seemed like the most established. He claimed there was a light version that could get down to 2 kilobytes, which that seems promising, but obviously is not as secure. Then there was the lattice-based cryptography, which that's the one I understand that seems like a really, really fat signature. I forgot the exact number of kilobytes, but I think it was like around 100 or something like that, like pretty fat. And then there's like newer forms of cryptography, but I think it's worth mentioning that those newer ones, like I don't think there's any chance we're going to use something newer. I think it's basically the Sphinx or the lattice, because all the other stuff, it's not like battle tested enough to even think about using, in my opinion.
To be clear, the signature much more than 100 bytes, thousands. Because like the current ECDSA is like, you know, around 70 bytes. Schnorr is 64 bytes.
So the one that
100 would be
100K, right?
Kilobytes. Kilobytes more.
Yeah. No. Oh, okay. Because he was saying two kilobytes for the Sphinx,
the abbreviated thing.
The like abbreviated thing, which that sounds like, okay, it's more, but like doable. Yeah. 100K. Yeah.
So what one question is just like, which technology to transition to or multiple? Because if you've got like one option that's really good for space efficiency, but bad computationally, and another that's the opposite, maybe add both the Bitcoin, and then different applications based on their needs will choose one or the other. So there's that decision. And then there's like the timing. Like, do we do it now to be safer against quantum computers with relatively inferior cryptography? Or do we wait until it gets better? And like, so that's one bucket of questions. Then, and obviously that question gets, it's much easier to reach consensus on that over time as the cryptography improves. I mean, we have a magic wand, and like in 15 years, we have post-quantum cryptography, which is the same size, same speed. This, you know, it supports hierarchical wallets. It supports multi-sig. There's like no drawbacks.
Yeah.
Well, it's easy to get
consensus. Of course.
Kind of like Schnorr signatures were easy to get consensus because there's basically no drawback and they had a bunch of benefits.
Right.
That's one bucket of questions. Another is, I think the thorniest question, and this is not really a technical one, it's more philosophical, but what to do with coins that don't transition to post-quantum cryptography, assuming we add that. So assuming we add that, and it's possible. And then let's even assume we have a large window of time for people to become aware, or whether intentionally or unintentionally, they move to new safe addresses. There are undoubtedly many lost keys. So coins that literally can never move due to lost keys. We don't know exactly how many, but it's clearly more than zero. So they'll never move. So what to do with those coins? And right now, there's an estimated 6 million Bitcoin that's exposed to quantum attacks. And I guess for our audience, to make sure, there's a couple, there's a long-range attack and a short-range attack. A long-range attack is if coins have had their public key exposed in a variety of different mechanisms, then it's considered a long-range attack, because if I possess a quantum computer, I know that public key. I know how much money's behind it. I go to work on it, create the private key. I steal the money. Whereas, I guess all but 6 million coins don't have their public key revealed. So the only way a quantum computer could steal those coins would be as you go to spend those coins. The legitimate owner goes to spend them. Part of that process, when you broadcast a transaction, is to reveal the public key, in which you'd need a much faster quantum computer. That's a short range.
Because it would be like while you're submitting it to the mempool, so you have like 10 minutes or so
crack 10 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
I want to add two thoughts in there that I did come away with from the summit that I think are important for everyone to understand. Number one, if you want the simplest TLDR on like how to be safe, don't reuse addresses. Like one of the big things I walked away with is like really, like we all know don't use reuse addresses, but like really don't reuse addresses. And if you have old coins at addresses that have been reused, probably a good idea to move them to an address you never use again. So like that's like the TLDR.
And several million coins are from reused addresses,
including. So the two things that I came away actually slightly more concerned on, because again, I'm not all that concerned in general, but I think it's fair to like show both sides, honestly. One, all the freaking exchanges are reusing. So you're talking like Binance, all these guys that are sitting there with a million, I mean, I guess that is this most of the 6 million coins. That to me is just like, insane. Like, how is it, you know?
But couldn't they fix that in like one fell swoop by just moving it?
And hopefully they will. Address? But like that
hopefully
requires...
Hopefully they're listening right now and they decide to prioritize it.
And like, but that's the other thing is like, yes, they could. But then, you know, in general, I'm assuming it's not just simple. It's like, hey, man, can you move those coins? Like when you're talking about that, that quantity of coins, there's probably like 10 people that need to sign off and like stakeholders and all this crap. And so that to me was like, whoa, like I can't believe Binance is just kind of like raw dogging their keys out there. The second thing is... there's something else. Oh, Peter Woolley made a really interesting point. And his point was, yes, there's only the 6 million coins that we know of that have publicly exposed pub keys. But like, how many more are you exposed to someone? And so he made that in the case of if you're opening Lightning channels or potentially if you're sharing your Xpub with someone, you know, someone that's helping you
if
do
you're like
multi-sig.
A BTC Bay merchant, you share your Xpub. Unless you run a BTC Bay server yourself, you would share your Xpub with someone else running a BTC Bay server.
And so in all of those cases, I mean, like most of these companies are probably great actors, whatever, but like, I think, you know, in adversarial thinking and you're thinking about incentives, it's like, you know, as the price gets higher and higher, who's within those organizations? Who has access to the data? At what point does it become like, you know, like we've talked about with like the potential for some crazy big hacks. It's like, you know, okay, maybe certain companies have great security practices, but as a billion becomes 10 billion becomes 100 billion becomes a trillion. At some point, you're going to start having major, even state actors coming in and getting people on the inside. And like, anyways, I did come away thinking there's probably a lot more than 6 million that have like real attack vectors.
Yep. So I think, but with a sufficient window of time for people to become worried and move their coins, we can get it down to less than 2 million coins that would be exposed. There's something like 1.7 million coins that are locked up with pay to pub key. In that particular script, it's not the pub key is exposed. Most of those are very early Bitcoiners. You know, there's analysis that suggests anywhere from 750,000 to 1 million of those are Satoshi's coins. Almost all of those addresses have exactly 50 Bitcoin in them because that was the Bitcoin reward for mining a block back then. And so these are mostly early miners that have all these coins. I believe someone who's done analysis on the coins, only like 10 addresses using pay to pub key have more than 50 Bitcoin. And I think the most was like 3,000 Bitcoin. Those are the ones that most likely a large percentage will never be moved. They have people are dead or that's lost keys.
Yeah.
And so that's where the philosophical question lies. Even if we assume we introduce post-quantum cryptography, even if it's perfect, it has no drawbacks, everyone's excited, everyone who can move coins moves all the coins. If we assume all that happens, and it's sufficiently large enough window that can happen. What about these coins that literally can't move? What do we do with them? So one camp is let the quantum computer steal it. And you already said that's the at least the camp you're in right now.
Right.
Some people might find that like to be a crazy camp, but it's definitely not a crazy, it's a completely rational view. There's substance behind that view, that position. I'd state the reasons behind it are, one is that we're never going to reach consensus on burning people's coins. And we don't want to violate people's properties by changing the software. And we all agree, whoever's coins there are, we don't even know if they can or can't spend them.
Yeah.
But we're going to make it sure that they can't spend them. We'll never get consensus on that change.
And I would say as a corollary to that, like, to me, the whole point of Bitcoin, like the one sacred cow that cannot be slain, is inviolable property rights. Like the whole system is inviolable property rights. And in my mind, you know, it's a very slippery slope. And like the discussion of what, to your point, trying to reach consensus, well, which ones are dead, which ones are not, it just starts to get very Ethereum very quickly in my mind.
But the reason why this is a very difficult problem is because no matter what choice is made, a right is being violated. Because if like, I signed up for Bitcoin because I have a private key and no one can take my money. unless they get my private key. Well, now all of a sudden, a quantum computer steals my money. So that violated my property rights of Bitcoin.
I disagree with that.
Well, so you said unless it can get your private key, and in that case, got your private key.
Correct. Yeah. To me, I want to be very like sort of explicit. What I think that, and I'm not saying it's not nice. It would be unfortunate. Like I'm not saying I don't feel bad for people to get caught up in that. But to be very clear, the whole point of Bitcoin at that base layer in my mind is code is law at that level. Right, like there are plenty of other things where code is law is insane, which again, the whole Ethereum project. Mm-hmm. But like at the level where a bearer asset, like ownership of the bearer asset to me is private key. Now, the sort of inviolable right that you're given with that private key in my mind is the right to hold that private key in the state that you received it. And so if the state that you received it gets hacked by a new technology, I mean, that was not the agreed upon state.
So that's one position. As I said, it's a, like valid position. Now another position is freeze or burn the coins, and I say, well, to me the difference between freezing and burning to me implies permanent loss. Freezing, there's like an option to unfreeze in the future. So what would that option to unfreeze look like? It would be the rightful owner can prove later on to the world mm-hmm. in a public fashion, these were my coins, and do so in a way that a quantum computer cannot prove and no one else can either. And it's already been demonstrated, like if you have the seed phrase mm-hmm. for your coins, that is one way to do it because the quantum computer cannot take a public or private key. It can't take the private key and reverse engineer the seed phrase because a hashing mechanism is used between them.
Right. So the quantum computer can go from a public key to a private key, but can't go from a private key to the seed phrase.
Yeah.
That is fascinating to me. And that's a very interesting nuance. Who would be the arbiter? Like, how would that work?
You take it offline. I think that's what the ZK stuff is.
You
right?
need a zero knowledge proof.
But again, who's like saying like, because
it could be added to the
you do
protocol.
A calculation.
So here's how it plays. Like, let's say we had to make an imminent decision.
Yeah.
Like, okay, quantum computer's here. It's going to steal. We have to make it. And let's say we get consensus to freeze.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that. We don't have to have a solution yet.
Yeah.
To do this social proof that, oh, these were my coins. We don't need that. We just need the optionality of it. So we freeze. So we change the code so that no one can spend those coins, even the rightful owner. And then in the future, whether it's 6 months later, 6 years later, or 60 years later, we develop a system which is fair, which is cryptographically sound, which is part of the protocol, and upgrade the system again, the software again. And then now I can take my seed phrase, wrap it, zero knowledge proof it, prove to the network, these were my coins and I get them back.
So the assumption there is there can only be one set of seed words that led to that private key. Is that right? But that's not true either, right? Because couldn't you have like when you're generating a seed, it could be 12 words or 24 words. Like, is it the case with this? I guess with a hash function, there's only one thing that leads to the private key.
Well, whether I have 12 or 24 words,
yeah.
Like I can prove that they
lead to that private key. And so I guess what I'm saying, just to clarify, is if I have 24 words that lead to that key, there's not another cell of 12 words that would lead to that key. Like in cryptography like this, it's only one, it's like a one-to-one mapping.
I mean, I need to go study it. Yeah, like, either way, key. Like, so what? I mean, it's just like...
You can't get either.
Yeah, okay.
Even if there's a collision there, like no one's going to guess the other option because it's like a huge number.
Yeah.
But there was also this discussion of the hourglass. Have you...
Oh, that was interesting, yeah.
Right. I thought that was...
Yeah, so there's like a couple variations of the hourglass proposal, but with the hourglass concept, you allow the quantum computer to steal the coins, but you apply a throttle. And the first proposal for hourglass would be each Bitcoin block would allow for like one paid above a key transaction spent. One per block. And if you, with that kind of throttle, it would take 8 months to spend all of them. So if someone possessed a quantum computer, instead of taking 3 hours, if you allowed full blocks to be mined this way, they'd all be spent and stolen in 3 hours. Mm. You apply this throttle and then it's 8 months. So it gives the whole space, time to react and come up with a plan while limiting the damage of the theft. And like one theory behind that is like, or one, I'd say one benefit to this approach is like by giving us more time, it would be easier to get consensus like, oh shit, this it's real now, it's a real problem. So it's just easier to get consensus on, do we freeze or do we introduce post-quantum cryptography, etc. And then, but you know, it's still tricky. Like, how do you, at what point do you believe a quantum computer is stealing the coins?
Yeah,
like we just saw thousands of Bitcoin. What was it?
80,000
Bitcoin just moved from an era that would. In fact, I think they were paid a pub key coins,
and I think they were assumed loss. Like I think there was, I forgot one of these so organizations.
No one's. I mean, I saw someone claiming maybe it's quantum, but like no one's taking it seriously that a quantum computer did that.
But it's certainly possible. I mean,
and that was 80,000. So how many have to move before we start believing it, and then more people believe it, and it becomes, you know. So it's still unclear. But that's the hourglass idea. There's an hourglass V2 proposal, which is way more. I don't know if I'd say more aggressive, but had very different parameters. Instead of just pay to pub key, it would throttle all 6 million. Like if it's a coin that's exposed to a long range attack, it gets throttled. And it takes like 120 years to spend all of them. I mean, like instead of 8 months, it's 120 years. It makes this a huge window.
That starts to mess with property rights, though.
That's what I agree starts on. To mess with property rights, right?
It doesn't start. It messes with property.
Like, if I can't even, like, if I'll be dead by the time I can spend my coins, like, and because the reason why the window of time was increased so much is that it was limited to an amount of one Bitcoin per one BTC per block.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So much more limiting. And then you have to start considering fees. So whether it's, you know, one address or one UTXO per block or one Bitcoin per block, either way, there's going to be competition for that. There's only one per block.
Right.
If you have one of those, you have one of those, and I have one of those, I want to be in the next block. Yeah. You want to be in the next block. How do we decide if there's contention?
I believe markets might help with that.
Markets, fees. We already have that built.
Are we going to have another block war, block size war?
But then, no. But
what
I mean,
if we just created a DAO?
No, but I mean, if the fee market. So then, okay. How much are you willing to spend to be in the next block? And like the proposal is that it limits the fee to match the amount you're trying to move. So in Hourglass V2 proposal, you can move a maximum of one Bitcoin and you can pay the miner a maximum fee of one Bitcoin. But one thing that was great about this event is that after hearing this proposal, then we broke out into breakout groups of around 6 or 7 people per group. And there are like 8 different breakout groups. And in my breakout group, we talked about what prevents out-of-band fees. So like the protocol in this, if we move forward to this proposal, I can only move one Bitcoin. I can pay the miner a maximum of one Bitcoin. But one question that gets raised is like, all three of us want to do this, right? We all three max bid one Bitcoin. Who gets chosen? Well, so the protocol could be random. It randomly selects one of us. But what prevents me from going to the miner and be like, I'll pay you even more money.
Right. And that already happens today.
To select me and don't follow the protocol, because the miner gets to choose what goes in the block. So the protocol might say it's randomly chosen between the three of us, but I ensure that I'm the one chosen because I pay even more fees to the miner. And then it's kind of a race to the bottom, because like if I have one of these blocks that I mined back, you know, in 2010 or whatever, and I have 50 Bitcoin in it, like I'll end up just spending, you know, 49, I'll be like, here, Mr. Miner, here's 49 Bitcoin to move one Bitcoin. And it just,
you got a deal.
Right.
So, anyhow, that's the hourglass idea.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different parameters that have to be, it needs to, that alone needs to be studied a lot to think of all the adversarial impact. And because it's all, it basically, it might simply just be in the end a tail emission. And like, if that's really, if it is the case that everyone just ends up paying 99% fees to get a little bit out, then that's basically a tail emission. So let's just be honest and call it
tail emission. Do a tail emission. Can you just define tail emission?
Well, tail emission in general is kind of like, right now, the way the Bitcoin network works is that the subsidy goes to zero. The only way miners get an economic incentive will be transaction fees. But if you add a tail emission, some people have proposed we add a tail emission.
Like Monero.
Which is like rewards that continue beyond.
Forever. And it could be something like in Monero, it's always like a fixed amount. So it's like 1% and then it gets less. So it's asymptotic with zero, but never zero.
So what, like one idea is take all these coins that are either thought to be lost or didn't move to post-quantum and we don't want, it's better to give it to miners than to a quantum computer thief, then come up with a formula for how to give them to miners over what time period, how to make that fair with the miners. That's a whole nother question.
I mean, so a couple things come out of that. I mean, for me, the thing that I keep coming back to is I think any changes ever made with Bitcoin should be the kind of changes that you as a user can opt into, full stop. Like, I love the idea of creating new post-quantum, you know, signature schemes. Amazing. But I should still have the, you know, the right to choose, like, in the future, do I want to use that or not? Anything in my mind that goes back and touches old coins and tries to, like, have any kind of paternalism about who may or may not be using them that we just don't know, it's a slippery slope to Ethereum. This is, like, what went wrong with Vitalik and all these guys thinking they understood complexity, thinking they could outsmart the system. And then, of course, it blows, it breaks, and it's a slippery slope. So that's my kind of high-level view on this. I'm not saying it's bad or good. I think that, like, you could do all these crazy things and, like, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, or you could just do nothing. And, like, often the, like, kind of, like, Taoist approach isn't the right approach. In fact, I think that's what Bitcoin is. So that's my high-level thought on that. I thought something that was very interesting to me, though, that I think is worth discussing is in one of my, actually, not my breakout group, but my lunch group, two very interesting things were mentioned that I actually thought was very important. So the first was someone mentioned at the table, they're not that worried about quantum itself, the threat. They're extremely worried about the recursive fear. So they're worried about the worry about quantum. Yeah. And I was like, yes. And that makes total sense to me. Someone else at the table was our mutual friend who's, you know, major public investor. And it seemed he kind of validated that the biggest thing holding a lot of just huge pools of capital back is that there isn't an answer. So I do think it's extremely important. To me, the most important thing is less like, okay, what do we do with the old coins? And like, yes, the post-quantum cryptography matters, but like, what is the education and the talking points? Like, how do we educate the big public guys? Because even if there's like very little like risk and like, yeah, maybe a couple million coins get lost forever. If they start thinking, well, what if everyone else is about to get out quickly? Right. And then, oh shit. And then it keeps going back on itself. Well, then I should get out before they get out. I think that is a much bigger concern. And I guess one question I'll pose to you guys is, if you were presenting some of these giant pools of capital, how would you tell them to like either assuage their fears or like not worry, or maybe they should worry? What would you tell them?
Well, one, I mean, you mentioned earlier, David, like how did this event come to be? Yeah. The unnamed investor you just mentioned kept nudging me over the past 2 years and I kept blowing him off. And finally, I'm like, I got sold on the point that even if I am not too worried about this,
right,
that others are. And we need to, we, the Bitcoin community, need a better answer than like, it's not a problem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I'm totally sold on that. And so, well, one thing led to the next and we had this event. So I think the event itself is one answer for investors. We've recorded all the content. It's all available. We also had people attending who are going to write summaries.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
But, you know, people from Bitcoin Magazine, but also research analysts at major firms.
Yeah, that's great.
So we'll see. And, you know, these are high quality people. I expect really good summaries and analysis from them. So looking forward to that. I think that'll come out the next month or two. And one thing I suggested when we wrapped up the event is that maybe that comes from the people that I just mentioned, but if not, I think they're so. Again, even though there's a lot of open questions still, a lot of big problems, we have a better answer than like it's not a problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so like, let's at least write down like, okay, here are the five big questions. And we just reviewed some of most of them. And then like, you know, if something happened in 5 years, literally what would happen?
Yeah.
What would happen? What would happen? What could happen? What's the best case outcome?
Right.
If it happens in 5 years, write that out and say like, here's the best thing we can think of that would happen. Here would be the plan. Here's the ramifications. We wouldn't have multisig, like the wallet. We'd have all like have to reset the software development. But, there would be, and then, but we could freeze coins or whatever. And basically like there'd be like very limited collateral damage in terms of theft from a quantum computer. Or option B is we can't get consensus on that change. And then it's like they are available for theft, and you have to be prepared as an investor that there's, 2 million coins that were just stolen, and that adversary can dump them on the market or play other shenanigans and games. I think writing down that in accessible language to investors would be a very valuable exercise.
And this continually unnamed investor, one thing he mentioned he was going to do, which I'm actually very excited to see, is compare, and these are different things, but it should at least take some of the danger out of that, is compare what's happened with like every major public tech company, was like by definition 100% insider owned from employees, founders, and investors. Then they went public, and over 10, 20 year period, it goes from like all insider owned to the vast majority public owned. And so, i.e. insiders have dumped, which I actually don't think they've dumped. They've just sold shares over time, just like Bitcoiners have. And so I think that was very interesting to see, like, and I'm gonna be very interested to read when he puts this out, to see how quickly some of those shares were sold to the public and how that impacted price. And like the TLDR was, except in like very, brief windows of time where maybe you got a couple, percentage point downtick, it didn't really impact price. There was always demand to keep taking that new supply. So I'm not that worried if like 2 million coins get quote unquote dumped. I also think that an attacker sophisticated enough, motivated by economics, they're not just going to dump all at once. They're going to like figure out how to, try and time that and maximize their own return over time. I do think the one thing that's a little different with this though is, one, if it's Satoshi coins, does that somehow just spook the market in a way that insider selling of Facebook or Amazon didn't? Maybe. And the other thing is, I forgot the other thing, but yeah.
Anything else to wrap up on the event?
I think we're pretty wrapped on the quantum. We got how long? Yeah, we're almost an hour in. No, maybe not that. How long are we?
42 minutes.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Oh, good. Okay.
There's a little timer in the bottom, right?
Oh, there you go.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
Beautiful.
Nice.
42.
Steve dropping the
we've got a high-tech setup here. Yeah. We've got timers. So
Well, we have some other topics. I don't know if we have the topics listed, because I know one of the ones that we want to talk about was the AI companions, but I don't think we have that
companions
listed.
I don't really remember. I haven't heard of companions.
I know it's a topic that we have maybe disagreements on.
Yeah.
Which I actually wanted to hash that out, because in the group chat, we never quite...
Hopefully we don't get fired from this conversation. Alex, we got to stay HR appropriate with this conversation.
We're definitely HR appropriate.
Okay.
Thank God.
But David, you kick us off, because you're saying that Elon and XAI's new companions is like could revolutionize the interface to AI.
Well, yeah. So I want to be clear about what I said, because you're misrepresenting it already. So I said that this is a disruptive interface, that if it were to become popular, it would not be easy for existing providers to kind of to adopt. And the point I was making is, if you think about most of information retrieval over the last decades has been web search, has been mostly Google. And so when, the Transformer is invented and ChatGPT becomes very popular, it's an independent app, independent experience, but it's like this text-based, chat-based experience. And Google has, I think, very effectively incorporated its own LLM technology into AI overviews that are part of the web search results page. So you look at the web search and then you get AI overviews, like, oh, that's interesting. And then there's this button that's dive deeper. And then you enter effectively like a ChatGPT-like chat interface. So there's this very natural glide path to go from like my old habits that billions of people use, which is type in a term, to kind of this new experience, which is this like chat thing with its text. And it kind of all flows nicely. It's a very nice glide path. My point is not that waifus are the future. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But if that behavior becomes popular, and if you're in the existing web search world or ChatGPT world, it's not clear how you sort of upgrade a gentle glide path. It's just a brand new starting point.
Could you tell us more about this waifu glide path?
So the waifu thing, I've used it for all of 10 seconds, so I'm not an expert at waifus.
Okay. Yeah.
So you have to
We've seen the movie Her, though, right?
Yeah,
sorry. Right. So you flip a switch on your Super Grok, right? You have to be subscribed to Grok and Super Grok. And you flip a switch for companions. And you're...
Is this even legal to pay money for this? At what point does that cross the line?
But you're talking to like a virtual girlfriend type experience, right?
But I think the thing I took issue to, like a statement was made about how like porn has been a driver of technology historically. Mm-hmm. And like that, I agree with. I mean, you can look up history and like whether it be VCRs or DVDs or even the browser and internet itself, like one of the first early adopter use cases that drove people to buy a VCR was porn.
Yep.
And so that definitely like catalyzed those technologies, and then people found other uses for them. So there's no disputing that. That's like historical fact. So having like a sexy guy or girl visually as the interface for AI, though, I don't see that as the equivalent, because in the case of like VCRs or whatever, like, I mean, there's the use case of like, I want porn. That's my use case. But then there's all these other. Yeah.
Tell us more about this use case.
There's other use cases of like, I just want to search for information, or I want to book travel, and I don't want like some kind of sexual interaction in the middle of that, of that use case. Yeah, right. So I would find it super annoying to have like anime in front of me, like in lingerie, like stockings, when I want to like book travel or like ask like a question about quantum computing.
Okay, so right? I will go on record and say waifus are the future. And I got waifu pilled in 2019. Steve, I hate to say it, you're not the target user, my friend, which is fine. I got waifu pilled because when I was living in what I would call sort of a nerdier MIT house with a lot of the early OpenAI people, one of them is, let's say, the smartest guy of that whole group. Like, this guy was an alternate on the U.S. national math team. That gives you an idea of what we're talking about here, okay? And he did a YC company, and they were doing, without giving away all of the details, I don't know if he wants everything on the internet, but...
You probably already said too much.
I probably said too much, but whatever. You know, they're using AI for kind of like, you know, graphics and animation and stuff like that. And, you know, kind of got a little traction here and there. And then they had something, I'll just say it, whatever, like go viral. So Waifu Labs. And Waifu Labs exploded in 2019. And there was all this talk on Hacker News, and people were calling them horrible and perverted. And yet the users just kept pouring in. Now, a lot of it was from Asia. So I think that's a huge thing to understand, is what you're really going after here is like Korea, Japan, China. Like that's a thing over there. But it's also in the United States. And I would say this is where, you know, to sort of give a bit of a nod to Autism Capital, I think they get this right. You win the autists have the culture, because they're the ones that are programming everything else. And so I think that Elon Musk, what makes him so amazing is he's not only an incredible engineer, he's not only a great business person, but he understands the internet, and he understands who these people are. And these are the people he's got working for him at places like XAI. And I would argue that for so many of those people, this is precisely what they want.
Help me understand. You said it exploded. What was the use case?
you created your own virtual girlfriend.
Yeah, but you.
And then their number one business model off of that was selling pillows.
But that's it. Okay,
but like, Steve is saying that doesn't translate to broad based information retrieval.
Yeah, it's not the new. It never became the new UI for how I obtain information, communicate with people, a complete task.
Maybe it wasn't good enough yet.
Maybe what I would say is it's about like this visual audio entry point to the internet instead of a text-based entry point. And if you're living in all of your UI and your browser and everything is oriented around a text-based input and kind of interaction, then this having an audio visual starting point, you know, much like the movie Her, which doesn't have quite the same visuals, but it's a very disruptive entry point. You can't glide from a Google search into that thing very easily. I think that's like the main point I'm making. Not that everything has to be done with the waifu, but that's just like a showy kind of a surprising starting point. But the idea of like, I could imagine a future where I'm issuing my travel prompts to an audio interface and doesn't have to have a animation of a person. It's just like in Her, didn't have an animation of a person, I think. It was just like vibes and then audio. But I think that's a very disruptive interface.
And I want to be clear, I think it's going to go sort of out from here. Like the experience I ultimately want is just like, personally, is just like AirPods. Like I'm just talking. I don't even care about the fucking screen. I do want to be able to talk and be like, hey, can you, whatever, book my flight for me? Can you take care of all these things? I think that's the way we're headed. But I think if you look at adoption curves, right, the early adopters are going to be, and we may not understand these people necessarily, but the ones that are chronically online are the ones that will use the waifu for everything. Now that's whatever, 1% of the population, whatever it may be, but those are the
early,
ones.
Early adopters of what though? I mean, ChatGPT already has 800 million users, right? We already have early adoption of AI.
Everything in your
life. We have late adoption of AI.
Yeah, but that, I would say that's still very like, that's like, if you're still having to go to a screen and type something, like that's like imagine you never turn this thing off. It's literally 24/7. It is your new friend. Everywhere you go, it goes. And I think that's like, maybe that's kind of what you're getting at as well, but it's a jump from like, oh, like I have a question or a query, I go and type it out. And so the people that are going to adopt having 24/7 on friends, and to be clear, I think it's going to grow out of waifus. I think that's the early adopters. But then from there, maybe you could imagine like, I don't know, you'll have for the Bitcoiners, like the Bitcoin guy, and you'll have all kinds of characters and whatever. Mm-hmm.
Steve is unconvinced.
No, I mean, I like we already have AI. People already use, hundreds of millions of people use AI. People speak to AI audio, and mm-hmm. there's no dispute there. Like the movie Her, I think will come true. People will develop emotional attachments to their AI.
Yeah.
I agree with all that. I just don't think porn is the interface for everything.
And to be clear, the companions thing is not a porn thing, but it's sexy, a little sexy. And I think it's more just a surprising departure from the utilitarian feel of everything on the internet. It's more like a entertainment-like feel. I would call it more so than a porn feel.
And I, again, like I would stress the point that this is aiming for people that play esports or watch Twitch. I'm not that audience. You guys are not that audience. But that's the audience that is chronically online. And that chronically online audience will be the first adopter of a 24/7 AI agent.
Yeah. There's also phenomenon, you've probably never seen this, but what's called Famify? Have you seen Famify? Famify is an extremely popular iPhone app where you live stream yourself as if you're an influencer and you get likes and comments and stuff from bots and you feel like a celebrity. And you'd be like, nobody would ever do that,
this
right?
This is how society ends, ladies and gentlemen.
Obviously not
waifus
something people would
Famify.
Do.
It's all over.
I just popped on it the other day on the App Store, and I think it had 100.
Pat myself on the back.
You're doing great, man.
I'm beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I'm so smart.
Stunning.
I'm so good.
So dope.
It really is. Like, but it kind of goes into that point. Like,
it's very dystopian.
What does it mean when you want likes and admiration from a person versus a bot? Like, I think everybody says, oh, I want it from a person, not a bot. The bot's not valuable. A person's valuable. But like, if you're never going to meet the person, if it's just some random out there, like, why does it matter?
Yeah. Well, I agree. I mean, to me, like, the value is if it's authentic.
Yeah.
So if, like, a really smart AI, like, it valued my work and said, good job.
Yeah.
And I'd learned over time that, like, it doesn't always do that.
Yeah.
It also is critical.
Yeah, yeah.
It has a high bar. It rarely gives praise, and it gave me praise. I would value that. So
yeah.
It's not like human versus AI. It's
right.
Just like, is it authentic?
Yeah.
And it sounds like this game is like just complete nonsense.
Steve is giving the roadmap for the waifu.
I think this game has like 180,000 reviews or ratings on the App Store.
Now,
so it's not small.
I think we can zoom out. Like, I agree with you 100%. For better or for worse, this is what's going to happen. Now I can put on my like human hat. Right? That's kind of my investor hat. Like there will be money to be made here. Elon doesn't fuck around. My hat that I put on as a human being though is kind of going, I think, some of your points, which is like, this could get very dark mirror, very, very, mm-hmm. very sad, very, very quickly. Because it, I mean, in a lot of ways, what it's accelerating is more of like people isolating from the rest of the world. It's like, you know, instead of having a real world relationship, you have this virtual girl. And like, instead of like, I don't know, like playing sports, you first, then you play video games, then you watch people play video games. So I don't get that either. Like to be clear, I think it's absolutely fucking insane. And like, I'm trying to get off of screens as much as possible. But, you know, I think you said this before, maybe that is the new luxury of this new world. And it's like, you know, I have mixed feelings on this.
The luxury being off screens, not the wife.
Not the wife.
Just to clarify. It's not the $20 a month.
It's not the $20 a month. But like, you know, the kind of like Bitcoin freedom perspective in me is like, I don't want to see everyone in the pod eating bugs. Like, mm-hmm. That sounds horrible. And like, I mean, but then it's like, well, shit, what do we do? Because like the forces of technology seem to be, you know, it's like, I feel like we're very much which way Western man, like the forces are pushing really fucking strong that way. Even though in general, in a lot of ways, I like Elon, I like what's going on with X and a lot of the models and stuff. Like, I mean, what they're all doing is harvesting attention, full stop. And like, then I say, well, what chance do we have in this digital world? And I think the best chance we have is the Bitcoin community, the Nostr community, like as much or just fucking throw your phone in the river. But I don't know if that's really an option. I mean, like, it's like, I mean, soon we'll have social credit scores. And like, if we don't have Bitcoin ready to rock and roll for that, what are you going to do?
I notice no one is chatting with us today. So I'm surprised people don't have views on this topic,
especially the quantum stuff or the wife is, I guess. It's because we're at a different time.
I'll chalk it up. Yeah, I'll chalk it up to the time.
I asked her AI. She said, we're doing great, guys.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what, Alex, we need, if we're not getting audience,
if nobody's here,
we're not getting audience engagement, we just add comments yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you sock puppet some stuff in there for us?
Can you give us some likes, you know? Maybe a few sats or a couple of Bitcoin.
Thank you.
Should we talk about mining and AI?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You've been excited.
I'm very excited.
Talk about that. I am as well.
Are you going to announce your new mining an AI venture?
Sure. I mean, I'll like at a very high level. I mean,
did Steve want to take us in a different direction?
I had a couple things to talk about, but
I'll frame it a little bit. So, you know, I've been telling you guys this, you know, I've been a solar maximalist longer than I've been a Bitcoin maximalist. I've been obsessed with the curves. So as a piece of context here, right? As an investor and just as a general sort of like enthusiast of the history of technology, one of the biggest lessons I've learned is when you see a natural law or order emerging, don't bet against it. It's that simple. Like, just trust the curves, man. And Moore's Law, like how many companies made, you know, whatever, like billions at that time when a billions was still worth something, of dollars off of betting on every, you know, 2 years, we're going to get a lot more transistors on here. It's going to get a lot faster, a lot cheaper. Just bet with the curves. And similarly, you know, the early AI people, and I, you know, lived with a lot of these people, and I was also very excited about this, is you just look at like, how many flops are we getting? What's the relationship between flops and, you know, model size and data training? Like, there are laws that emerge for all of this stuff always, or maybe not always, but in most technological trends, right? And by the way, I think that's something, you know, I mentioned to another one of our mutual investor friends here, is something that I would also love to see come out of this quantum summit is, what exactly, I'm still not sure, what is the Moore's Law-like relationship we should be tracking? As we think about how to freak out, the thing I want to know is like, what exactly is it flops per qubit? Or I don't know what that relationship is.
Error rates and then connecting.
Yes.
The different node.
And whatever the size is, right? So like, I'd love to see this chart on a few things versus qubits, versus, I don't know, perhaps like total computational or energy spend, whatever it is. And so anyways, So that's all there. Now, I found one of these curves and became obsessed with it in the, I guess, early 2010s, maybe a little bit later, maybe like 2014, era. And basically what I started seeing was that solar, which is, you know, by the way, I heard a fantastic podcast. We need to rebrand solar panels to quantum converters. I agree 100%. Mm-hmm. You're taking photons and creating electricity with it. You're literally creating a shift in a quantum state, and it's magical. And solar panels, basically, you know, it's very similar to semiconductor. In fact, it is a semiconductor technology. And as you, deploy more solar panels, the end levelized cost of electricity has just gotten, like, it's fallen at a consistent rate. Every time we have cumulative capacity, the end levelized cost of electricity falls 40%, full stop. Now, you can debate a little bit on those numbers depending on your data set, but like, that's generally the relationship. Now, people will come in, they'll say, yes, but like, solar will never solve the problems because, you know, the sun only shines during the day. What about at night? What about when it's cloudy and we need firm power? It's like, look, there is another curve to follow, which is the battery curve. And every doubling of cumulative capacity for lithium ion batteries, and this is particularly at scale, right? Like there are new technologies, first you have a breakthrough and then you have the scaling. And the scaling is where, as an investor, I can just look at the curve and trust the curve. Every doubling of cumulative capacity of lithium ion batteries, price per kilowatt hour, falls roughly 20 to 25%, again, depending on the data set you look at, like clockwork. Now, the good news is these relationships critically are not time relationships. They are functions of units deployed. So what that means is if you deploy this stuff faster, you get the cost falling faster. This was the core thesis of the 2021 Bitcoin paper. Bitcoin is key to an abundant clean energy future, which at the time also sounded crazy, but like you just follow the curves. Faster you deploy that stuff, cheaper it gets.
We're seeing this in China, right?
Exactly. And so this sounds kind of horrible, but whatever. This is PBJ. We keep it real. I've heard from certain solar enthusiasts who have tried to explain this to people and people just don't get it. They're like, oh no, that'll never work. Natural gas, blah, blah, blah. The one thing that is getting them traction on this argument is a little old-fashioned xenophobia. When they show a chart and say, hey, did you realize that China has deployed, you know, there's many numbers you can use. The one that I remember very clearly off the top of my head is they are on track to deploy over the next 3 to 4 years just in solar. Forget nuclear. And there is a place for nuclear, but it's much smaller than like mainstream would have you believe. There is a place for nat gas, much smaller than mainstream would have you believe. There's basically not a place for coal, but that's a separate story. Just the amount of solar they're deploying on the world today, just solar, in the next 3 to 4 years, the current rate they're on will be more than the entire generation capacity of everything in the United States. Natural gas, which is our like big bread and butter, coal, solar, wind, all of it. Even though we're deploying solar very quickly too. So the Chinese are on top of this. They're literally paving their country in solar panels, and China is leading far and away on batteries, lithium ion batteries. That's why they have electric cars now that are like, you know, they can charge them faster than you can even charge a Tesla, which by the way, the only person that really seems to get this in the United States is Elon Musk. And thank God, because that gives us a shot to compete with China. So that's all what's happening with solar and batteries. And by
what
the way,
are the bottlenecks?
In terms of what?
Well, if you can look at all these curves and, you know, figure out as an investor that it makes sense, like, isn't there anybody else who's looking at those curves? And
oh, yeah.
So what are the bottlenecks? Why wouldn't it, like, why do we not have the whole of the Southwest painted in solar panels right now?
Well,
is it like regulation? Do we need tax incentives? Like,
we're not in the right point, the curve. Yeah.
We're getting to that
point.
Like, we're like right at that point. And so there's many ways to answer that. One is sort of philosophical, which is why is everyone in the world not all in on Bitcoin? There's like understanding and diffusion, and like people are busy, and like people are used to an old world. And like we're going through another thing that came away from the quantum summit is like phase shifts. The world operates in phase shifts. It's not linear growth. It's like, no, there is a phase shift. We're going through a phase shift in energy. We're going through a phase shift in money. Those things are the same. By the way, Bitcoin, quantum computing, AI, all of it comes down to joules, always joules. Mm-hmm. Energy is the base, full stop. And so why have we not deployed a lot more? Well, to be clear, we're deploying a lot of solar and we're starting to deploy a lot more batteries. So to Steve's point, we're right at that point on the curve, which is why this is my current obsession. Like, I don't know if I'm, you know, I've invested in a few companies. I'm extremely bullish on Satoshi Energy. I'm extremely bullish on Crusoe, which I'm not an investor in, but oh my God, those two companies are going to kill it. I'm extremely bullish on Tesla and Redwood Materials, which spun out Tesla.
David and I are investors.
Well, I'm jealous. I'm super jealous.
<You know. laughs>
Chase is actually an investor in HiMind, and I'm hopeful maybe there'll be some stuff to do in the future with all that, but you guys are in a good spot. Like, that company is fucking killing it. And so what's going on here? Well, the reason we haven't deployed even more is number one, the grid itself, regulation and the grid itself, right? So let me just give you guys a quick, there's so much swimming in my head here, and I'm hopeful I'm going to be able to put this together, and like, I need to put out like a long essay that just goes into this in like excruciating detail, but let me try and get this high level. The other thing that's changing right now is demand, right? In the past, we haven't also had to do this crazy shit I'm about to talk about because there wasn't the real demand. It's like, yeah, we could all use a little bit more electricity, but like the electricity industry and the power industry, it's a very sleepy industry. The utilities are mostly government granted monopolies and like don't really care. And these guys kind of collect their paychecks and they set rates, and it's not really free market capitalism, right? Now, what's happening is that the shift, the reason the curves were crossing that point in the curves faster than a lot of people expected is AI. And so what's happening is the demand for power is literally going parabolic. And so to give you guys a little sense, and shout out to Brock Peterson, co-founder of Satoshi Energy, one of the companies I'm most bullish on the world, very, very, very lucky to be an investor there. Oh my God, you guys know what's up. And by the way, kudos to them for coining the term energy-backed money, because they understood where this was going a long time ago, many years ago with Bitcoin, right? But Brock said in a recent podcast, which if you go to my Twitter feed, I shared the podcast on there, that in Texas right now, okay, there's a peak demand of about 80 gigawatts. That means that for the whole state of Texas, like if you're running your refrigerators and your air conditioners and there's an aluminum smelter and industrial, everything, it's about 80 gigawatts peak demand. That's the amount of power you're pulling from the grid. Okay. Guess how much there is right now? I may have already told you, so don't say if I didn't. Okay. There is, just to build AI data centers, demand. 140. Okay. So almost double all of the humans. So the big story here is that humans are becoming a rounding error. The AI wave has barely even started, and we're already trying to double all of human capacity in the most free market in the United States, and therefore probably the world, in Texas, and we haven't even started. And now you're looking around, you're seeing like fucking Mark Zuckerberg is coming out here dropping, oh, I don't know, unlimited money, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars on researchers, has confirmed plans to build multi-gigawatt data centers right now. One of them, 5 gigawatts, will be footprint of Manhattan. Okay. So, and that's one company. And that's a company that's playing catch up to a company that's going to absolutely smoke him on that front, which is Elon Musk, XAI, because they're the only ones that have access to all the elements that you need for this, the solar, the power walls, the batteries, and in the short run, the natural gas generators to back that up. I'm not saying natural gas and nuclear will have a short term place in this, but they can't compete on cost in the long run. Elon understands this. So when you look at all these things coming together, it's no surprise that some of the stuff you were sharing in the chat, which is that a lot of the old companies that started off as Bitcoin miners and were all in on this, now effectively are taking those sites that they were brokering for Bitcoin miners and just giving it to big tech to build AI data centers, because the demand, like, they will pay any price for it. I'm being a little bit, you know, whatever. I'm being a little ridiculous that, of course, there is a price, but like,
but it's not as mercenary. Like, you can look at the dollar flow and the you know, what you can sell it for.
Yes.
In the case of Bitcoin, in AI, you're always investing for a further forward future.
At least 3x more in AI, and often way more. Now, and Bitcoin still has a role in all this, right? I'm still extremely bullish on Bitcoin mining, and it's going to go up too from here. But anyways, but the TLDR, my current obsession, if there are Bitcoin and or energy entrepreneurs or people that are thinking about entrepreneurs, maybe you're, I don't know, about to leave Tesla, and you're interested in this, my number one goal right now is basically, how do we build all of this? The grid can't take it. The regulation is way too slow. There's over 400 gigawatts of solar and storage alone in the interconnection queue in ERCOT, which is Texas. It's not getting approved. They're moving way too slow. Even if the government comes in and says, hey guys, again, xenophobia at play, China's racing ahead, slash all regulations, build baby build, we cannot keep up, full stop. The grid's too old, machine's too broken. So my new obsession is, I got a couple of people I'm starting to ideate with here. I definitely want to make a few investments on this trend. I may incubate a thing or two here as well, is how do we build all this off-grid and then reconnect it later, probably settling over Bitcoin and Lightning, into a new, eventually, Buckminster Fuller-style intercontinental solar and battery-powered grid. That's where we're headed. One last data point, and then I'll let you guys jump in on this. The most important story of the last month, in my opinion, is Redwood Materials, which founded by J.B. Straubel, co-founder of Tesla, current board member of Tesla, spun out of Tesla. And they are recycling lithium ion batteries from Teslas, now with GM. That means they can get the cost of batteries low enough where it starts to make sense to go totally off grid. Late last year, one of the DR dudes, I forget his name, microgrid dudes, he put out a paper with some of the Stripe people saying, hey guys, it could make sense in theory to build a totally off grid solar battery powered data center. And everyone was like, oh yeah, that's cool in theory, but like, it's not happening. And if it's not happening, it means it's not real, right? Because the market builds what's real. Redwood now announced Redwood Energy, and in conjunction with Crusoe, has built the first operational, not theoretical, it's live today with Crusoe's data centers. Shout out to Chase, that man is on top of this stuff. And they have built the first totally solar and battery powered data center. It's 12 megawatts. To give you a sense, that's small in the comparison of things I'm thinking about, but it's not nothing. In fact, it's 20 acres of solar panels. It's a lot, right? My new sort of like fantasy and where I'm going is, how do you go from 12 megawatts to 12 terawatts? And that's...
And you want to do this as a totally brand new grid. Not like, well, the existing stuff. You want to do totally brand new infrastructure.
I think you go off grid first, and then you rebuild a new grid. And then if you're
does off grid mean you're connecting with like end consumers or industrial applications? Or are you doing it all with Bitcoin mining, or how do you sort of?
Well, to be determined, and that's why I'm looking for the right people to partner with on doing this, because I think there's a couple of ways you can go. I'm still figuring out exactly what the play is, but primarily you're just powering data centers, so it's like totally off grid AI compute. I think Bitcoin mining.
Solar plus battery.
Bitcoin mining can play certainly a role here for sure. And I think that like there are certain advantages you have with things like Bitcoin mining that you don't have with the AI compute. For example, the Bitcoin miners, you know, you can just like turn on and off at a moment's notice. With the AI compute, you might be able to do some of that for inference. If you're doing a big model training run, you can't do that. So I think there's probably something in kind of combining these things, potentially even eventually combining them with, you know, some of the like longer term stuff, like the green hydrogen, like the desal, the desalination of water, like all kinds of crazy things. But I think where Bitcoin is going to play a big role is you kind of have each of these nodes pop up. And I think there's also something very interesting around how these data centers could potentially be a sort of linked up, uncensorable cloud as well. And I think that's a necessary ingredient for the digital life stuff we've talked about. But that's its own rabbit hole. But eventually you could link these different nodes in the grid up. And the way you would have to do that, if you're going to get around a lot of the old school regulatory and like, you know, basically, I don't mean to shit on the old grid and stuff. What I'm saying is the old world is dying. And in order to feed the bots in this new world, we need a new paradigm for energy. And the old grid ain't going to cut it.
The main thing I wanted to add to the conversation many episodes ago, you brought up the topic of like, you know, what's the impact of Bitcoin mining when a lot of these Bitcoin miners or their sites are transitioning to AI and high performance computing, because there's like more money to be made there. And at the time I'm like, no, whatever, like mine will just pop up elsewhere. Like either there's profits to be had or there's not. So, yeah. And I still think that's true.
Yeah.
But like the new insight is that companies driving AI and data centers, it's not necessarily incompatible with Bitcoin mining. Because what Bitcoin miners have done well at historically is identify low-cost energy locations and begin building them out. Because as we know, Bitcoin mining, there's really only two primary cost components: buying the equipment and low cost energy. So once you have your equipment, the only thing you optimize for as a business really is low cost energy.
Correct.
So site surveys and identifying that's important. The other thing is Bitcoin mining doesn't need as much infrastructure as most other applications of energy. So you can be like, I've been to remote locations in Kenya. They're like 6 hours from Nairobi. It's like out in the middle of nowhere, but there's water flowing there, cheap energy, and they added Bitcoin mining. So Bitcoin miners are very good at identifying those locations, begin Bitcoin mining, but those locations don't yet have the infrastructure for AI, like high speed internet, because Bitcoin doesn't require high speed internet and other infrastructure. Yeah. So what companies that want to do, you know, use these locations for AI with low energy, they have to wait until it matures so that it has stronger infrastructure, more robust infrastructure for AI.
Although one data point on that is that Crusoe is lowering that barrier with their new sort of off-grid compute cluster. Yes, you still fiber and all those things make it better, but like both things are happening. Like it is, the bar is getting lowered.
So there's always going to be a need to develop new sites and find cheap energy. Mm-hmm. And so Bitcoin mining can be that scout.
Yes. It's like, the tip of the spear.
And also the economic, and it reminds me of the paper that you wrote and worked with Block on 4 years ago, because the idea there too is like, well, there's all this energy, the renewable energy that can't just waiting to be connected to the grid, or it's built out for a city. And the supply was built out for a 25-year plan, but for many years the city's not creating the demand.
Yeah.
So you have all this wasted supply. Well, guess what? Plug in Bitcoin mining for the supply that's not used by the city yet.
Yes.
And it reduces the economic cost for the project. So it's a similar dynamic here, I think. As a site goes from nothing to has energy, to has all the infrastructure you need for AI, that takes a period of time.
Yes.
And Bitcoin mining could be plugged in then.
And I think it's important. And honestly, it'd be awesome. So Alex, I don't know if we can get this in the show notes as well, but that paper, Bitcoin is Key to an Abundant Clean Energy Future. It's interesting, not only for those sort of arguments, but ARC built a model with that paper, which allowed you to kind of see when does it make sense for, you know, solar batteries to go fully, you know, powering Bitcoin miners. And of course, there's nuance there, right? Like it's one thing if you're using the sort of deprecated S9s versus newer miners, because then, you know, you could do it without the batteries, et cetera, et cetera. But I think one thing that's changed since then, it'd be interesting to rerun those numbers in the model, which I actually haven't done yet. But again, is, you know, the fact that Crusoe and Redwood have built a 12 megawatt site that pencils enough, at least for them to show it as a demo, is, again, the secret is trust the curves. As I said, this is super, super important point. It's not time dependent, it's scale dependent, volume dependent. So if you start deploying that stuff like crazy, and the other thing that I'm always looking at is look at XAI's public filings in Memphis, right? And there's like through like a lattice work of different companies, but they're buying up a lot of land. And so I fully expect Elon to
pay. In Memphis.
Yes, and around Memphis, which by the way, represent. it's no surprise that—
How is that?
It's not a coincidence. It's not. I stopped being a coincidence a long time ago.
He's the Memphis guy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
it's my birthplace. It's going to be the birthplace of yours truly and AGI, nice. Or whatever we're calling it now, super intelligence. So the important point is, as, and to your point, like this is where you have to get kind of in the nitty gritty and why I'm looking for the right people to work with on this idea. We're right around where it's starting to make sense. Like, could be a few more months in some cases, but the faster that Elon and co start paving the world in solar panels, everyone gets that benefit. The faster China starts paving, that benefit, like Bitcoin, flows through to anyone that wants to be an entrepreneur in the space. Now, to be clear, it's going to be cutthroat, right? Because, I mean, you're literally competing against China. Not necessarily competing against China, but like, they're out there buying the panels. They're also making the panels. The more they deploy them, the cheaper they get. But anyways, the point is like mining, it probably is going to be a very tough business.
Is most of the manufacturing of the panels done in China? Like all of it, basically?
Yes, and there's a whole, there are some that have moved out of there, but effectively, yes. And that's another whole topic and very sort of potential issue for concern. I think that's another thing that needs to be reshored to the United States or to U.S. allies like Mexico is, you know, there's concerns around, you know, even the inverters and the solar panels alike. Can that be hacked and like listening to us? Probably. So anyways, point is, it's a really, really exciting space. I'm going to be obsessed with this for the next couple of months. I know you guys both may have some ideas on who these entrepreneurs could be, but if you're listening to this—
Yeah, I already found your CEO.
Let's fucking go, baby. Get ready.
I'm in.
All right.
I'll make the intro after the show.
I love it.
All right. I'll write an angel check.
So we had so many exciting topics queued up today. I'm just gonna throw us into another one.
Okay,
which is probably a short one.
Okay,
but so many people in Bitcoin love that how number go up and like they get excited about the price and it hits $100,000 and now it's like 120 and whatever. So it's always in relative to U.S. dollars. That's what people typically quote. U.S. dollars is what most people, certainly Americans, but people globally, like generally understand what a dollar is worth. It's extremely rare to quote the price of Bitcoin relative to gold.
Right.
And I really haven't thought too much about that. But then just the other day, you mentioned like you gave a shout out to Danny for I forget exactly what, but I mean basically relating it to that metric.
Yeah, I'll pull up the tweet.
So then I was curious about the history chart. Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm aware gold has increased from in the neighborhood of, it's basically doubled in the past four years or so.
Yeah.
From like 1600 and something to 3300 and something per ounce. So I was just curious about how does that match up to Bitcoin's rise? And obviously you can cherry pick various time frames to pick your story, but I was just surprised that you, because usually Bitcoin outperforms like everything if you zoom out to 4+ years. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you zoom into less than a year, then it's all bets are off.
Knows, yeah.
But if you zoom out enough, and usually it's 4 years, it's just a guarantee that it like wildly outperforms anything you compare it to. But when I looked at gold the past 4 years, it actually was flat. Now, in the intervening 4 years, it went up and down. But it's Bitcoin has not gained value on gold in the past 4 years. Mm-hmm. That took me by surprise. So The main thing I think
in gold terms.
In gold terms. Yeah.
Yeah.
BTC
yeah.
measured in gold.
Yeah. It surprises me because I'd say the most common elevator pitch or anchor to convince people like, oh, what is Bitcoin's TAM or market value is gold. Because gold is kind of indisputable in terms of like, what is its market cap? It's been around thousands of years. There's a lot of people who don't believe in it or don't like it as an investment vehicle, but you can't dispute that it's worth this much money and it has a long, long history. It's just indisputable.
Yep. Right.
So Bitcoiners have the similarities between Bitcoin and gold are quite, there's a lot of overlap. Bitcoin has almost every property that gold has. It's only missing one or two. Like it only has really like one or two drawbacks to gold.
Primary one being just it's not Lindy in the same way. Like gold's 5,000 years.
No, it needs 16. The internet. And then it can have software bugs. Like gold can't have software bugs. So I think those are like the two inherent drawbacks it can't be. But it has tons of advantages over gold, right? So Bitcoiners, like that's pretty, like once you see that, it's hard to unsee. And then you're like, well, obviously Bitcoin is going to eat gold's lunch. And that doesn't mean gold goes to zero because again, it has these inherent advantages over Bitcoin. So I think it'll always have value, but the relative value between Bitcoin and gold, you know, we all expect Bitcoin to rise and probably just far surpass gold. And then you can get, you know, you can compare it to real estate and bonds and all this other stuff to size the market. But because it's still much less than gold, I would have just expected over the past 4 years, and we're kind of in a bullish market. It's not like we're in the trough of a bad winter or something, that it wouldn't have been flat relative to gold. And it has. So my advice to us and to everyone else is we should talk about and look at the price of Bitcoin relative to gold as much as we do the US dollar.
I agree.
I think it's way healthier. And I think that actually was your point, or that Danny was making that point or whatever, right? So I think we should. So like we should develop the discipline to celebrate milestones relative to gold as much as we do US dollar.
Right. And I think there's another piece of context to add there, which is Danny was making some crazy price predictions. And I have also made some, I don't care too much about the price, but made some predictions around price over the next whatever year that a lot of people are like, that sounds pretty wild. And I think the key, one of the key pieces of logic, at least for Danny, and I just kind of got this a little bit intuitively, is, when you're pricing in dollars, the dollar, the whole reason we have Bitcoin in the first place is I always think about Bitcoin as sort of like the metric unit for value. And I think one day that'll be measured in joules once we're fully monetized. But the point is, like, if I told you, like, hey, like, how tall are you today? I go from being, well, hey guys, I'm actually 6'5" now. And you're like, what? When did you turn 6'5"? It's like, well, when I changed the definition of an inch. It's right. Like meaningless, right? If I'm telling you like, hey guys, it's $120,000. It's like, cool. But like, what is the purchasing power of a dollar today versus in 2020 if we printed, 50% more dollars or 25% more dollars? And I've seen, reports you need to earn 25% more to be competitive.
What
if
I told you there are 2.1 quadrillion Bitcoin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, fair enough. So anyways, but the point is gold, obviously, even though it's not perfect and there is some, 1-3% increase in supply every year, it's much better than the dollar. And so it's much more interesting to measure that. And Danny's point was, the bull market and all-time high actually just happened last week.
So, I'll read the tweet. So the tweet from Danny says, looking at Bitcoin priced in gold, we've only just reached the previous cycle's high.
Correct.
A historically proper cycle move up could put us at a ratio of 137, which at current gold prices would be $479,765 by the end of the year.
Yeah. So another mental exercise that I did after seeing that data and thinking about it more. Like, given that the price of Bitcoin relative to gold today is basically the same as it was 4 years ago, if we knew that then, or gold has been a better investment the past 4 years. That's the assertion I make. Because obviously it performed the same and is less risky because it has thousands of years of history. obviously, anyone investing in Bitcoin relative to gold today expects it to outperform because that has way more risks. It has quantum computing risk. Does gold have quantum computing risks? No. So Bitcoin still has a number of risks. Obviously, every year it gets de-risked, but there's still a number of risks with Bitcoin. Gold doesn't have them. So if it performs, so if we knew right now that over the next like 8 years, Bitcoin's going to $1 million and gold is going to $30,000.
Is it like a 10x?
They're both 10xing roughly. Mm-hmm. That if we knew that for a fact over the next 8 years, 10 years, whatever, which would you invest in? Obviously gold, because that has less.
You got a regular Peter Schiff here. Who would know?
I mean, like, guys, hold on.
Like, I mean, if we knew that's the performance, the price performance, why would you not invest in gold?
Well, that's less price performance. So what does it matter, right?
Yeah. But anyway, that's why, I mean, I'm not predicting that's what's going to happen. I'm saying if we knew that was the performance, obviously gold's a better investment. So my main learning is that we need to monitor that metric way more often.
Yeah.
And that's at least as healthy of metric to look at as the dollar, if not better metric to look at as a health metric for the adoption of Bitcoin.
So there is one really important piece of color. I don't have the data in front of me and I haven't, done thorough analysis, but I seem to recall this guy, Charles Capriol, puts out some really nice charts, including the Bitcoin energy value of money, which is what I chart pretty closely. And which is basically cost of Bitcoin measured in joules. And I think I remember reading this on one of his charts. It basically his sort of takeaway is that gold pops before Bitcoin does always. I don't know if that's true and I'd have to go back and check that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's what I remember this. That's not the case.
I definitely don't think that's the case.
Okay. Well,
they're quite uncorrelated actually.
So, well, at least in this market, what he was claiming is that, give it whatever, 3 to 6 months after gold starts popping, Bitcoin's going to start ripping. And it seems interesting to me that if that's the case and we're just starting to rip and we just touched all-time high and this whole thing is extremely reflexive, that the bull market literally hasn't started. And so that all of the crazy FOMO and reflexivity, basically the argument is things are going to be more or less the same as it was every other cycle, maybe a little bit dampened as it does every cycle, but it's just the size is bigger and people are like, oh, but that's impossible. How do we get the kind of capital inflows to get to $500,000 a coin? And the answer is, from institutions and countries. So
I agree overall with the point that we should be using gold as a better metric or kind of better yardstick to try to understand truth here than US dollar. So overall, I'm on board with that idea. I think the one thing I would say that is a risk to gold is the existence of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is so much better in so many ways. Not to suggest that Bitcoin has to go to zero, not that gold has to go to zero, but just as people who are born today never knew a world without Bitcoin. It's just a thing, just like we've never known a world without gold. And I think, people will update their expectations around how, they want internet native tools instead of the offline stuff. And so I think there is some risk to gold because Bitcoin is a better version assessments. Doesn't mean it's going, doesn't mean one wins and the other loses. It could both, they could both grow, or one might grow and the other might shrink a bit. But I would say that there is a risk to gold that we should be cognizant of, which is that Bitcoin now exists and it's a credible competitor.
That's why I expect Bitcoin to outperform gold over time.
Yeah.
So let's keep looking at that metric. I mean, the reality is, the reason why I don't think there's that gold pops for Bitcoin is because I have the gold price chart in my head pretty well from 2010 on, and from 2010 until 2021 or so, it's pretty flat.
Interesting.
Something 1,600, 1,700, 1,800 per ounce, maybe flirting with 2,000 a little bit, flirting with 1,500 a little bit, but pretty tight range over a decade.
Yeah.
And then a big doubling.
Yeah.
And so, where it obviously Bitcoin has had incredible multiple cycles and an incredible appreciation over that entire time.
Yeah.
And even if you look prior to 2010, there's fewer pops in gold than is in Bitcoin.
Yeah, fair enough.
But they're big movements, and then it tends to hold them. Mm-hmm. But then it moves sideways for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So probably moving forward, we'll see the 10x appreciation in Bitcoin over whatever, something like 8 year, 10 years, and we won't see 10x in gold. Well, it might be flat the next 10 years. Or maybe it has one more pop the next 10 years, but that doubles.
Yeah.
So like in 10 years, Bitcoin's a million, gold is 6 or 7,000. And then, and that would kind of line up with most people's intuition, I think, about the risk reward of each investment. But let's look at that metric and see how it plays out.
Let's keep watching.
Yeah. Cool.
Someone should make a really nice, Danny, if you're listening to this, I know you're trying to vibe code a lot more. It'd be nice to have just like a simple, like, btcandgold.com or something like. Just easy chart.
I like it.
It can speak for every like movement. Danny vibe coded the Bitcoin to US dollar. Yeah.
And he could even have a waifu.
It's the Bitcoin speaker. All right.
On that note,
shall we then?
I think we shall.
Okay.